water, earth, fire, air. Months ago, all of us could come and go as we pleased in harmony. Then everything changed when the pandemic attacked. Only the TV series Avatar, The Last Airbender, a series our friends kept telling us about, would stop us from anxiously watching the news. But just when we needed to stream it most, it vanished.
About a year has passed since my cousin and I started podcasting about Avatar, and although we've all been through a lot in this past year, we believed Aang could save the world. And you know what? We were right. After ending the 100-year war, with the help of their friends, Avatar Aang and Fire Lord Zuko transformed the Fire Nation colonies into the United Republic of Nations, a society where benders and non-benders from all over the world could live and thrive in peace and harmony. They named the capital of this great land Republic City. Avatar Aang accomplished many remarkable things in his life, but sadly, his time in the world came to an end. And like the cycle of the seasons, the cycle of the Avatar began anew. This is Kin Folklore, Avatar, the Legend of Korra.
People of Republic City, welcome to Kin Folklore. We're back to explore the world of Avatar by delving into the complexities of its sequel, The Legend of Korra. I'm Andrea.
And I'm Paul, and we're cousins who podcast about our favorite fantasy and sci-fi television shows. After concluding our coverage of Avatar: The Last Airbender, we decided to continue exploring the world of bending by covering the comics and now following the journey of Avatar Korra as she navigates the post-war world.
Last week, Sue realized that one of her closest confidants was a traitorous member of the Red Lotus. The Earth Kingdom descended into essential chaos when Zaheer assassinated the Earth Queen, and we learned what the Order of the Red Lotus is after: a post-Avatar world without nations, borders, or governments.
Chaos is the natural order of things. It is.
This week, we conclude our coverage of Book 3 with an epic face-off between the collective Team Avatar and the Order of the Red Lotus.
And you know what, Kin Folklore? There will be adult content. And you know what else is the natural order of things? Your grandmama embarrassing you in front of two of the people you used to date but dumped you or you broke up with and saying, why don't you date nice girls like this? If you're here for that kind of content, for grandma shipping, you've come to the right place. Let's go. The first episode is the ultimatum. It begins with Mako and Bolin wandering through the upper ring while the upper ring looks like the Rodney King riots.
It's bad. Just
yes.
Complete looting, chaos, just not good.
Yeah, it's really, really rough. And, you know, knowing that they have to get Zaheer's message to Korra, I don't know why they're... I mean, I guess it is an important message to get. I mean, he's about to murk a whole nation of people for the second time in 100 years. So, yes, it's very important. So they're rushing, and they try to commandeer an airship. You know, Mako rolls in, like, in the middle of anarchy, talking about, I need to commandeer this airship on behalf of the Republic City Police. Nobody cares about the police.
Nobody cares. Nobody cares, Mako.
Yeah.
It's chaos.
Yeah.
The queen is dead.
The queen is dead, okay? And so Bolin knows what is speaking to these people's heart at this moment. He goes, hey, I know where the gold is. It's over there. And they bounce. They're out of here, right? And he's like, you got to know how to talk to the people, which I agree. And they try to take off in the airship, and the airship take off a bit rocky. I mean, Bolin is not good.
Just because he dated Asami doesn't mean, you know, Mako knows how to do this, and Bolin doesn't know how to do it at all.
No, Bolin kicks it off, and you know they get in the air, kind of rocky, take off, but they do get in the air, and on their way out of the city, they realize, wait, our family's down there. Good call. We're gonna stop and see if we can scoop them up. So they stop and hover over the house. They go in. Boleyn rolls in. But Grandma ain't trying to leave. She is a monarchist through and through. Queen Elizabeth would be proud. She'd be super proud.
Respect. You know? I grew up in a household where my grandfather was a true monarchist. You couldn't say anything about Queen Elizabeth in his presence. You know, I get it. Respect.
Yeah, I feel it. But you know what? They're about to burn to a crisp. And Boleyn's like talking and she's all, no, I'm not leaving. This is my home. I raised my family here. So Boleyn's like, you leave me no choice. Grabs her, throws her over the shoulder. And Granny, even though she's protesting, must grab the picture of the Earth Queen. You know what? Even in her picture, she looks trash.
She really does. I mean, I'm saying I respect Grandma, but Boleyn was right. Respectfully grab her and get her out of there.
Exactly. Exactly. So after traveling through the desert, they're like kind of like looking around to see where they can find Cora's wreck. And they do see the wreckage of the warship and of the airship. And eventually they realize that the tracks of what was going on lead them back to one of the worst resorts in the history of resorts. The Misty Palms Oasis. Boleyn reunites with Pabu without actually, like, you know, recognizing that he hadn't been with Pabu for a while until mid-sentence. He's like, oh my God, Pabu, you're here. And then he's kissing Pabu, and Grandma's a little bit, she's a little bit grossed out. She's like, why is he kissing this big rat? I don't understand.
Grandma's takes on Naga and Pabu are excellent.
I love it. I love it. She's the best. I like Grandma. Grandma's a nice addition. And they do find Korra, Asami, Beifong, Zuko, and Tunrock, and Boleyn is speechless. Oh my God, it's Zuko. I can't believe it. Zuko. Oh wow. It's like meeting Michael Jordan. Right? After watching The Last Dance, for all you newbies that didn't get to see him play, it's like meeting him then. It's like meeting him then.
Do you think Boleyn knows about Zuko and his honor? Or do you think he only knows about him as a Fire Lord?
I mean, he does. Jenora knows about honor, 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 honor. I don't think Boleyn knows. I think he just knows about him as a Fire Lord and all the things that he did and accomplished. But, you know, maybe Mako, you know, Mako's a lot cheerier after meeting Zuko. Maybe Zuko pulled him to the side and was like, you know, I used to be broody just like you. It doesn't go anywhere. You should calm down. So Grandma does what Grandma does, and she thinks that Asami is the Avatar and starts remarking about the size of Korra's arms and basically tells Mako that he should date someone like them, like I said earlier. And that's pretty
really
embarrassing.
Awkward. Super awkward.
It's super awkward. Asami changes the subject right away. She's like, so, what are you guys, how did you guys get out of where you were? So anyway, Mako delivers Zaheer's message that he's going to wipe out the new Air Nation if Korra does not turn herself over to him. Team Avatar doesn't have a radio in the airship, but they have one on the Jeep that will reach Zaufu. They message Sue, who tries to reach Tenzin at the Northern Air Temple, but can't get through. But they go to Zaufu. My question is this. If they could radio Sue, why the fuck did they go to Zaufu first? Just radio her, tell her try to get Tenzin, and then head to the Air Temple.
I have no answer for this. I just... This was almost... Listen, we're not there yet. But let me just say, a lot of this reminded me of Bad Plan from Game of Thrones. I know we talk about Game of Thrones a lot. I'm sure that annoys some people. But, like, this is... You know what? This isn't like Bad Plan. This is like when they were... No, it is part of Bad Plan. When they went up to the north to get the white. Mm-hmm. And they get stuck up there because that's obvious. And then all of a sudden, within a few hours, Daenerys shows up with her dragons.
Yeah.
When we have spent the majority of this show traveling from north to south or east to west.
Yeah, this is what I don't understand. I don't know how far Zafu is. I don't know how far the Northern Air Temple is from the Misty Palms Oasis. I need a map. I need to really figure that out. But I mean,
yeah. So we know that Zafu is not far from Misty Palms because they drove from Zafu to Misty Palms in the Jeep, right?
Good call.
So we know it's not that far. It's less than a day's journey. I just don't. If you're really scared, wouldn't it make sense that even just tell Zuko to get on the back of his dragon and head up to the air temple, or send Zuko to Zafu and send everybody else to the air temple? Like, this doesn't make sense. They have more than one mode. They now have two airships. They have more than one mode of transportation, and they still have the Jeep.
It would make sense, except Zuko's, we haven't gotten there, but Zuko's packing his shit. He's out of here. He's not fucking with them. He's like, I'm gone. I'm going back to the Fire Nation. My daughter's over there. I got to protect my kids. I mean, which is super uncharacteristic of Zuko, by the way. He would not just be like, yo, I'm bouncing. I'm going to go back and just do that.
We will talk about how many members of team, the OG Team Avatar, act out of character in the show. But yes, it's strange. The whole thing is odd.
So with time running out, since they took a detour and went the wrong direction, Korra plans to go into the spirit world and try to trap Zaheer there. So she ends up going in, and Asami is like, I'll watch her while she goes into the spirit world. And everyone's like, yeah, sure, that's fine. Asami's the only person who can't bend. Is someone planning on shooting the fair one? Like, I mean, she's going to be like, yo, let's shoot the fair one. No bending. Please. Like, it's crazy. So luckily, it's not necessary. It's just, she can just chill there while she meditates. And as she's in the spirit world, Korra bumps into Iroh, who is still just rolling through the spirit world, trying to get a teapot, you know what I mean? And he bumps into Korra instead. And, you know, basically she says, since I've lost the connection to the previous avatars, I feel like alone. I can't talk to Aang. I want to be able to find out what he would do in this situation. And she's feeling stuck, you know, like I'm the only avatar since Avatar Wan who can't consult any of his previous lives. And he says, well, you know, Zuko was really good friends with Aang. They started off a little rocky, as we know.
Zuko tried to kill him multiple times.
Kill him multiple times.
A little rocky.
And this is when he says that Aang became lifelong friends with Zuko and never mentions Katara at all.
It's wild. It's crazy. Okay, so I thought about this for a minute because I was like, okay, maybe he knows that it's hard to reach Katara right now because Katara is in the Southern Water Tribe. And then I'm like, well, how would Iroh know that?
Yeah.
Like, how would he know where Korra... Like, how would he know Zuko's with her? How? This makes no sense. Okay, you know who else was really good friends? The person who had 3 children with him.
Who, by the way, like, your dad lives in the same fucking tribe as. Right there. And you grew up in.
Right. A person you know really well. Yeah. Like, why don't you... It would have just been better writing if Korra, if he had said, like, you know, you are close to Katara, why don't you speak to Katara? She can counsel you the way that I counseled Aang and Zuko. And she said, well, I can't reach Katara. And he said, well, what about Zuko? That would have made more sense. But he's just like, you know who you should speak to? Zuko, my nephew.
Yeah, because like everyone else in this world, they forget that Katara is one of the main reasons why the 100-Year War was able to be stopped. Like, yes, it was all of the team, but Katara freed the fucking Avatar. How is she so how is she so minimized in this fucking world?
Also, I you know what? I'm actually not going to say it. I'm just going to hold this for later. I just can't get over this whole exchange. I was just like, this is bizarre. Like, Cora literally grew up with the woman who was Aang's closest friend until she was Aang's girlfriend and then wife.
Yeah, yeah.
And she has been under the tutelage of Aang's son. And Iroh is like, you should speak to Zuko. He would know best what Aang wants. I know that she can't reach Katara and Tenzin in this moment. And Tenzin is in peril, which is why she's even having this conversation. So, like, I get the story mechanics that why this happens. But what doesn't make sense is Iroh just knowing that Zuko is easy for her to reach.
Yeah, I totally agree.
I don't get it. But okay, let's move on. I'm getting salty about the Katara erasure, and that's really your role on the podcast.
So. I mean, I'm super upset about it. I mean, honestly, it's really great. I'm glad to see you here with me. It's awesome. It's awesome. You've been here with me, but I'm glad you're verbalizing this. You've been trying to balance me out like the Avatar and be like, listen, okay, I'm going to let you have that one. All right, so Korra returns to the physical world, though, and she decides she's got to go talk to somebody who we all know who that is now. She's going to go talk to Zuko, who's preparing to return to the Fire Nation. And she says appropriately, I thought you were coming with us to the Northern Temple. He says, no. If they're taking out world leaders, the Fire Nation might be next. I'm going home to protect my daughter. You know what? Good pops. Again, highlighting that Zuko is probably one of the better parents out of everyone in this. Him and Katara constantly winning out here.
Okay, but again, I have another solution for this. Why not just call young General Iroh and send him home to protect his mom? Anyway, it's a really good call
because you know what? You know what they could have really used over at the Northern Air Temple? A fucking dragon. They could have really used that. With a combustion bender, a dragon would have come in handy.
It's true. It's true.
Oh, man. Good call. I'm with you on that. So finally, he says he's going to go back there to go be with his daughter. And, you know, Korra agrees that he should protect the new Fire Lord. But he also tells her that there was nothing more important to Aang than rebuilding the Air Nation. That he would be really happy with what Korra has accomplished as the Avatar. But he also notes that while the Air Nation was close to Aang's heart, he was the Avatar for all nations. He was concerned with the well-being of every single one of them. And that he would have, you know, figured out a way to work with this. So Bolin has finally got through to the Air Temple. And none other than Milo is giving him the runaround. Milo's like, yo, we found Air Bison.
No. First Milo's like, Bolin is not here. Bolin is like, I'm Bolin. I am Bolin. He distracts, after Bolin's so frustrated, then he distracts him with the bison. It's just, it's a great exchange. I love it. And it reminds me of when Milo picked up the phone at his parents' house in book one. That was funny too.
It was so great. And Milo's great. Milo, I love him. But this is the only thing Milo responds to. This is how you know Korra knows these children. She like goes and like, you know, gives him the military jargon, and Milo responds right away and gets his dad, right? She's like, listen, go get him. This is your commanding officer. Go get your dad right now. He's like, okay, yeah, sure. So she lets them know that he's on his way, that basically Zaheer is on his way to the Northern Air Temple. And Tenzin makes, you know, a gasp, and it's too late. Zaheer's already there. There is no on his way. Zaheer is there right away. And the airbenders attempt to evacuate, but they are captured by the members of the Red Lotus. Zaheer tells them that he is using the airbenders as leverage to get Korra. And Tenzin vows to never let this happen. And asks his siblings to help him fight. And they kick off the fight with Zaheer and the Red Lotus. And, you know, they're going at it. I mean, actually, it's kind of crazy to see Tenzin really, really fight. Like, mm-hmm. he was going in, right?
Yeah. I mean, we've seen him fight before, but I love seeing all three of them together. I mean, it's just, I'm not crazy about the fact that Bumi became a bender, but seeing the three of them fight, you know, Katara and Aang's children fighting side by side, and Tenzin's ready to die for this.
Yes, he is.
He's really, really ready to go. Like, he will do anything in service to what he believes is right. So it's a cool scene.
I agree. I loved it. And the others try to flee, and Pali makes it difficult for them to leave the temple with her combustion bending, fire blasting everything. Kai decides to be the distraction to Pali, and he runs off the cliff. Very impressive moment for Kai. And she follows him, blasting after him, and then while the others run to the bison, and then she blasts Kai out of the sky, and we see him drop, and Jinora's just mortified at this moment. Like, she can't even believe that Kai sacrificed himself, so we believe in this moment. And the Red Lotus members, they're really, really tough opponents, and as you mentioned, Aang and Katara's children are really digging deep to try to figure out how to stop them. Kai and Bumi fight until they're cornered. I love that Bumi doesn't just resort to the bending, though. He also resorts to biting, kicking, strangling. Like, he goes for what he knows. He's like, listen. And as they are clinging to the side of a wall, because they eventually fall out of the temple, Pali blasts them and sends them tumbling to the ground. Tenzin does his very best to hold on, but then he's now the only person. Yo, they jumped my boy.
Yeah, they sure did.
He didn't learn the first rule of street fighting, right? Because he wasn't really from the streets. Like, when you're getting jumped, you got to keep moving. You can't stand still. Like, he was, like, cornered and standing still and talking shit and trying to swing and go. No, you got to keep your legs moving. You're going to get jumped, bro. They're not shooting. There's no shooting the fair one in this one either. Like, it's just bad. And they beat him up. And the camera, this is a wild decision. The camera cuts away and all you hear is them just wrecking Tenzin.
Yeah. I mean, I actually thought Tenzin might beat. The first time watched this, I thought, are they going to have Tenzin be beaten to death? Like, that would be very dark for the show. But they, you know, one episode ago, we already watched them essentially suffocate the Earth Queen. So I was like, wow, they're taking it there. But, you know, of course, that's not exactly what happens. But
and thank goodness. And to that, we saw Kai fall. Jinora was very upset. We were very upset. But Kai awakes in a tree with his leg caught in a tree limb and a baby bison licking his face, who then he jumps on the back of and they fly away. And that's how the episode ends.
It's a crazy episode. Episode 12 is called Enter the Void. So aboard their airship, Sue, Lin, and, you know, basically the rest of the gang that's assembled there, discuss the strategy while it starts to sort of sink into Korra what she's going to have to do. Korra's starting to understand that the only plan that will work is for her to give herself up. I cannot get over when she tells them this, because Tonrock is like, no, don't do it. And then he's like, okay, we got your back.
I gotta say, I'm so glad that that's your take, because as a dad, I was sitting there like, there's no fucking way.
Yeah.
There's just no way.
You are a dad of a daughter who is a similar age. No way. I don't care if she's the Avatar.
There's no way. There's absolutely no way. You know what I mean? Like, it just would happen. Yeah, for sure.
Yeah, I just couldn't get over this. I was like, I don't believe. Like, part of me wants to believe this is Tonrock having a moment of character growth, because he's sheltered her so much. But then the other part of me is like, no parent would have just gone along with this. Like,
especially a parent who was instrumental in locking up this crew the first time because they were trying to kidnap her.
Right.
So he has the lived experience of being in fear of the fact that people were hunting his daughter. And he's like, yeah, okay, cool. We have your back while you go and give yourself up to the very same people who I essentially helped to put in jail so that they would not be able to get you.
Yeah, it happens too quickly. Like, they needed a scene where Korra explained to him her reasoning, and they just need more space for this, because he goes from being like no to being like, okay, we will support you.
Yeah.
100%. So Korra contacts Zaheer and offers a trade. He tells her to go to the top of Lahima's peak alone, and that he will release the airbenders to, you know, the others who are with her. Su, however, has a plan. Because the Red Lotus don't know how many people are with them, she sees an advantage. Her suggestion is that Mako, Bolin, and Asami fly the airship to the top of the peak. And then Su, her metal benders, Lin, and the others approach the peak from below. So back at the air temple, Zaheer meditates with Guru Lahima's medallion, repeating, empty and become wind. He and Poli, they have a moment here. It's, if they weren't, you know, essentially monsters, it would have been cute.
I mean, she's dwarfing him, though. I mean, I was looking, I was like, man, this guy's hair is like bulky, but very small, like very, very small. Or is she just big?
I think she's just big, but I actually loved that. Like the scene where they're embracing and Pali is so much bigger than him. I actually really liked that, because often like there's this, especially in fiction, there's a sense that like women have to be petite to be desirable. But these two clearly very much love each other. She's like double his size.
Yeah. I mean, I didn't want her to be petite. I actually liked that she was bigger too. I just a taller, like, you know what I mean. But I just thought that it was just stark to me, because I'd never seen them like close like that. They've either been sitting down or fighting. So it was like, whoa, okay. And I thought that was a good representation. My question is, I actually want to know more about. Actually, this scene made me like, and I don't want to go too far into this, made me want to know more about Pali and her story.
Yep.
Because when she says the thing about being, you know, saved by a warlord, from a warlord, and what he did for her, like, it makes sense that she would fall in love with him, but I want to know, how did she end up there? Who is she? Like, I still want to know, is she related to the other combustion man? Like, she seems like an interesting character.
Yeah, I wanted to know more about her story too, because the very mention of a warlord made me just wonder, where exactly is she from? Is this a warlord in the Fire Nation? Is this in one of the colonies? Like, I just need more information about this. So they have this beautiful moment where he basically tells her there won't be, you know, once they've accomplished their goal, there won't be any more running, no more prison. They'll be able to be together, but also the world will be changed. So this essentially functions as sort of a goodbye before they go into battle. And Korra is also saying her goodbyes to everyone before she heads up to the peak. Mako, Bolin, and Asami arrive at the temple, and they see the destruction that Pali has wrought. It's basically the entire temple's on flames. Like, it's just, it looks terrible.
Yeah, it's rough.
Gazan greets them and takes them to the airbenders, while Korra waits for word from Mako that the airbenders are safe while she's standing on the peak. He radios that the airbenders are there, and then Korra turns her over to Zaheer and Pali. After she has been shackled, Team Avatar realizes there was a trick. The airbenders are not there, actually. Only Tenzin is there, and then a bunch of decoys that Ming Hao had created with water. Korra resists suddenly, because now she's hearing over the radio, abort the plan. And she begins fighting Zaheer and Pali, and Mako sends word to Lin and Su to get Korra out of there as soon as possible, which, honestly, good on Mako. He's like, very definitive. You need to get Korra out of there.
Yep.
Like, 100%. He is not, there's no like, it was a trap. It was, he says, Chief, you have to get Korra out of there. So
I do want to mention that the machinist, or I don't know, Asami, or one of the engineers, not only helped in like bringing about the radio, but somehow walkie talkies. I don't know. I just want to throw it out there. I mean, I didn't want to let that go by, that someone in this world created walkie-talkies. I don't know when it happened, but it did happen.
I mean, yes. And we've had a lot of questions about the communication in this world, but suddenly radios, walkie-talkies are like a common thing here.
Uh-huh.
So after Mako tells Lin to get Korra out of there, Pali stays behind to fight the Metalbenders while Zaheer attempts to get Korra onto the airship. Tahn Rock shows up and rescues Korra and sends the airship away. Meanwhile, Bolin and Mako start to fight Ming and Gazan. Gazan fills the room with lava, leaving an injured Tenzin, Mako, Bolin, and Asami with very little options to escape. They're essentially trapped by lava. Tenzin tells them he might know another way to get out, and Bolin earthbends his way into another room with a tunnel beneath it. However, the lava has taken over most of the temple at this point and is chasing them through the tunnel, despite Bolin's best effort to block it with earthbending. So every time he puts up a wall, the lava just kind of burns through it.
Mm-hmm.
Meanwhile, back on the peak, Tahn Rock and Korra are fighting Zaheer, and they're putting up a pretty decent fight, honestly. Considering that Korra can't really use her arms and legs appropriately, like, they're doing a pretty decent job.
100%.
But Zaheer sends Tahn Rock over the edge of the cliff, and he falls below.
With an evil tagline, "Say hello to the Earth Queen for me."
Yeah, that was terrible. But it also was like, it was a good reminder that Tahn Rock is not just Korra's father, but also the leader of the Southern Tribe.
Yep.
Like, when he said the thing about the Earth Queen, I realized that Zaheer probably would have killed Tahn Rock eventually anyway, because he's killing
he
all
was on
of
that
the,
mission.
Yep. All of the leaders. So Sue and Lin are nearby, but cornered by Pali. When Lin decides that she's going to make a sacrifice to save her sister, just as it looks like Pali is about to kill Lin with a blast, Sue takes off her armor, metal bends it, and like shoots it onto Pali's head.
Oh, what a good
killing
move.
Her in the process. This was crazy. If this had been live action rather than animated, this would have been a horribly gruesome scene.
Yeah, 100%. And it just, I mean, let's just, she's not on screen, but shouts to Toph Beifong. Like, for first inventing metal bending and then having two kids who are like, yo, I mean, that move that Sue pulls is like, I'm taking something I'm wearing, metal bending it mid-air, wrapping it around your head to save my sister's life. I mean, it was seamless. It's such a strong move. Like, such a strong bending
move. Yeah, it was cool. A cool move. Again, kind of gruesome when you think about what happened to Palate, right? So she's like getting her combustion going, and now she's her head is encased. So she basically exploded herself.
I mean, Sparky Sparky Boom Man Part 2. I don't know what to say. I don't really have... I'm not having a bunch of compassion in my heart
Fully. I guess I do feel kind of sorry for her. But anyway, we'll come back to whether or not the show emotionally manipulated us right before they took this character out. So Zaheer feels this happen. Like, I'm sure he can hear it because it's not that far away, but like, he feels that his girlfriend has just been killed. And he manages to capture Korra. Just as Lin and Sue reach the top, he repeats that meditation from earlier and dives off the cliff with Korra in his arms.
Wild.
To Lin and Sue's absolute shock, Zaheer can fly. I was also like, okay, so who's underneath? Like, does he have a bison? Yeah. Like, what's going on?
It was crazy.
It was really, because flying is such like a rare skill in the world, it was dope. Let's just give Zaheer credit where credit's due.
Nah, it was crazy dope. And you know what? They had planted these seeds for like a while, since the beginning. Like, this guy has been, and what's cool is that this guy has been infatuated with the only other person in the world to do this, Guru Lahima since the very beginning. He was quoting him in the prison. He was thinking about it. So he has had a thing about Guru Lahima for a while. I actually wondered whether Guru Lahima was maybe one of the people who founded the Red Lotus.
Ooh.
I don't know.
Yeah, that's interesting. Interesting. We know the Red Lotus was started by someone else, though, right?
Yeah, actually, yeah, he does say who started the Red Lotus, but I just think, like, he had to have some tie-in. It just seems so random that he would pick this guru of the Air Nomads. You're right. There was another person who started the Red Lotus. You're exactly right.
But I wonder if, like, this guru's principles are some of the Red Lotus's principles. Anyway, it's interesting. I'd like to know more about this guru.
Yeah.
So, Tom Rock had been saved. He did not actually fall to his death off of the cliff. A metal bender saved him. He watches in horror as Zaheer escapes with his daughter. Meanwhile, Tenzin, Bolin, Mako, and Asami, remember them? Lava is still chasing them. They're still trapped in the temple. They finally reach an exit that leads to nowhere. Like, it just opens up into the sky. And Bolin, in a moment of desperation, somehow manages to bend the lava and stop it. It's pretty dope. Bolin is a lava bender.
He's a lava bender.
Really cool.
Oh, yeah.
And I love how he discovers this in a moment of desperation, the same way that Toph became a metal bender.
Uh-huh.
Out of desperation. So Kai arrives and saves them on the back of his baby bison, all of their grown asses.
Yo, that guy, that bison was hurting.
Yes.
Yeah, hurting. You know what I mean?
All of these grown people. And Tenzin does not look like a tiny guy.
No.
These grown people. He's not. Tenzin is essentially dead weight. Jump on this baby bison that's already carrying Kai. Crazy stuff. As they fly away, Tenzin looks in horror at the temple, which is basically destroyed by the lava. They join the others, and Lin and Sue tell them that Zaheer can fly, and everybody's shook. Apparently, this is a skill that only Guru Lahima had like 1,000 years ago, and it was basically lost to time. Kai tells them that he thinks he knows where the airbenders are. They're in some caves a few miles away being tended to other people that we've never met before. So there's more than just 4 members of the Red Lotus. Just when they contemplate how they're going to get there, Oogie comes in just like Appa would have, saves a day, and arrives to take them to the cave. When Ming and Gazan talk to Zaheer, he tells them that he was able to fly because he's no longer bound to the earth by worldly desires. He has entered the void. And he also mentions, you know, Pulley is dead. Very casual.
Yeah. Yeah. He's like, she gave her life up for our cause. Moving on.
anyway, we have things to do. Zaheer takes them to Korra, who is bound in platinum, and she believes that Tan Rock is dead. She's not just like shackled in platinum, but she also believes her father to be dead. And he tells her that her pain will soon be over and asks 2 members of the Red Lotus to bring the poison. And that's how the episode ends.
God, this guy, man. God, this is all I can say. Just doubling back a little bit with this guy who's a fanatic of Guru Lahima. Zhai Bao was the person who founded the Red Lotus. And I don't know if Lahima had any connection with the Red Lotus, but he was notoriously known as a poet and a writer inside of the, you know, and from the Northern Air Temple. So that's probably why all this happens there at the Northern Air Temple. But anyway, point being, Zaheer is like just such a fanatic, and he's decided that this is the philosophy and the place he's willing to stand and die on. And it brings us to Venom of the Red Lotus. Sahir tells Korra that the poison will activate her avatar state against her will, really, like that, because the avatar state will activate to try to save her because she's, you know, the poison is going to try to kill her. And it's going to try to keep her alive. They will then kill her while she's in the avatar state, thus ending the cycle. Andrea and I spoke about this a little bit offline, and we first introduced the idea that the cycle could be broken when in the avatar state, when Roku was speaking to Aang on the back of the dragon and explaining that that was when the avatar was most vulnerable. People remember that are fans of the original series will also remember how much fear there was when Aang was shocked with lightning bending by Azula while in the avatar state, and how that really put his life at risk, but also the chance of breaking the avatar cycle. So this is a big deal, and he's kind of thought this out. He makes his villain speech, you know, all villains have one.
It's,
you know,
just, they tell you it is so, I'm like, bruh, had you just done what you said you were gonna do instead of making speeches, this would have ended up very differently.
Yeah, 100%, because she wouldn't even have known. She would have just been like, oh wow, they're killing me, or I'm dead. And it would, but she realizes what his whole plan is. He tells the whole plan because, you know, he has to let her know that, like, this is what they're gonna do. And saying once the cycle is broken, they'll create a world without kings and queens, where a man's only allegiance will be to the fact that there's still a patriarchy, because it's only a man's allegiance. He destroyed the whole world except for the patriarchy. Go figure. And, you know, and that it'll be the only who he himself loves and those he chooses, you know, those he loves, right? So this is what Zaheer is talking about. He's got this whole one world order. There's no more kings and queens. Let's make this happen. So the whole thing is being watched by Jenora, who is using her spirit projection skill, and she is in the chamber. When Jenora returns to the airbenders, they're all thinking, Ikki even says, Korra's going to save us, and she's like, I think we're going to have to figure this out on our own. Good look by Jenora, though, because telling them that Korra was captured the way that she was and in the state that she was could have dampened the mood and put them all in panic mode. She just has that information and knows that something else has, they have to come up with a different plan, mm-hmm. right? And so basically we also look over and see Kaya and Bumi are not doing so well. So here, minions, I love that we always call like the people who are like totally like ancillary to the villains minions. It's like my favorite part. Like, it's like great. It's so awesome. So Zaheer's minions administer the poison, and Gazan and Ming prepared to kill her once she's in the avatar state. But Korra's resisting because, you know what? They didn't realize Korra has been through a lot of shit in her life. She's not going to just go without a fight. And proof...
And she's stubborn.
Yeah.
She's, like, incredibly stubborn. Like, it serves her well in that.
Exactly. 100%. And you know... True to the fact that she's gone through a lot of shit and is stubborn, she starts seeing all the shit she's been through. Like, all her fucking trauma is coming out because of this poison. She sees Amon, Unalaq, Vatu. The only motherfucker that didn't show up was Unavatu. That's it. Everybody else. Everybody is there taunting her. And back inside the cave where the airbenders are, they decide to use a little trickery to get past the guards, asking for some water. They're saying, hey, can we get some water? Even Pema's like, come on, we got kids, all that. So he comes over, and right then, Jenora airbends and gets his keys. He doesn't notice that they've got them, but they slide them over to Opal. Opal frees herself with the keys just as Sue and Lin and Asami and the others arrive. And they wreck the guards, get rid of them. Asami, yo, fighting skills.
My girl comes in strong.
Strong. Like, save these
kids. She comes
kids.
In strong. I was like, yeah, Asami's not playing games.
Not at all. Not at all. I'm here for it. And then, you know, they're in and they rescue the kid. They rescue the airbenders, and the airbenders are free. Back inside the cave where Korra's being tortured, Korra enters the avatar state. But rather than being killed, she's able to fight back and break free. Tone Rock.
Okay, Can we just talk about how they seem surprised by this?
Yeah.
I was like, why are you guys surprised? They were totally unprepared for Korra to be able to fight them. It's the Avatar state.
I mean, it's a bad idea to be like, we're going to get you into your strongest thing and we're not going to sneak attack you. We're going to rely on fucking metal chains or platinum chains and rock. So I can't break the platinum chains, but it's still rock. Like, it's not like I can't pull out of the rock. You know what I mean? Like, it was wild that they didn't think this one through.
Yeah, they seem genuinely surprised that Korra is able to bust out. And I'm like, okay, you obviously never saw the Avatar state before, because this was not surprising at all. It would have been shocking to me if she wasn't able to bust
100%. Out. That's exactly how I felt. And it wasn't shocking to Tonrak, Mako, and Bolin either when they reached the chamber and they're like, oh shit, Korra's in the Avatar state and she's chasing Zaheer out of this place. Like, Zaheer went from like, I got the upper hand to let me fly my ass up out of here because I'm about to get wrecked. In the scene that is kind of like a flashback or a callback to Aang's battle with Ozai, Zaheer and Korra fight amongst rock formations, like breaking shit up, going into the rock. It's really intense and it's super awesome, like, actually to watch. Mm-hmm. It shows you, you know, I thought about it. I was watching it again and I was saying, man, Korra is really like desperate in this moment to survive. And she's probably the strongest that we've seen her in this moment, because that survival instinct has creeped in. You know what I mean? Like, you're not going to kill me. I know I'm fighting this poison, but I'm also going to fight you. And Tonrak tells the group they have to help Korra. And below, Bolin and Mako battle Minghua and Gazan. Bolin is extremely pleased to show off his new lava bending abilities, because the guy's like, you know, I'm laughing at you. And I can think about how I wrecked you last time. And he's like, well, things have changed, buddy. Let me show you. And so that was pretty cool. And outside the battle between Korra and Zaheer only continues to get more intense. Korra gains an advantage, but the poison begins to take a significant effect on her. On the ground, the others aren't sure how to help. When Tenzin mentions that Zaheer has unlocked airbending abilities that haven't existed for thousands of years, Jinora does Jinora things. And she says, yeah, but there also haven't been airbenders for a very long time either, but that they are powerful together. And she asks all the airbenders to create a circle. Mako manages to knock out Ming and she descends into a cavern where she thinks, you know, she's going to get him because there's all this water there. And she has plenty of water to fight him with, and it looks pretty much like Mako's done. But just as she's about to finish him, Mako shocks her using lightning bending. Why hasn't he been using lightning bending a lot more?
It's pretty cool.
I just love it.
And the way he uses it is so casual. Yeah. He's just like, he just like shocks her and he's like, oh gosh, that was a lot.
Yeah. And you know what?
It's pretty cool.
It's pretty cool. You know what's pretty fascinating too is it made me think when he does it, you know, I was watching an episode this last time, it made me think about the origin of lightning bending that Iroh gives us, right? Talking about the fact that it's a water bending technique that actually allows for firebenders to lightning bend, right? Like combining those techniques. So it's actually really cool that it happens the way it happens when they're down there and he's at the disadvantage of a waterbender to pull that out. And I was kind of, it made me think about it. So it's pretty cool.
It was nice to see Mako finally get a win.
Yeah.
Like, he's been taking L's regularly. So
deservingly so.
Good to see him.
Deservingly so.
Yeah. Yes. I mean, yes. We don't care for Mako, but I like Bolin, so, you know, whatever. Let's celebrate his brother's one up at bat.
Yeah. Well, yeah, it's good. It's a good look. So Mako goes back and joins his brother in the fight with Gazan, who after swearing, yo, he's never going back to prison. I actually felt him on this one. Like, I felt him deeply.
Me too. I was like, damn, Gazan is a G. Like, he's really not. He's like, not having
yo,
that.
If I'm going down, I'm just going down, but I'm never going back to prison. So he tears the whole cave down over his head. The cave collapses and kills Gazan and Ming, but Mako and Bolin escape. Zaheer is close to finishing Korra outside by taking the air from her body, doing the same thing he did to the Earth Queen. But the airbenders in their circle interrupt this by creating a cyclone so strong that it overcomes him and starts to suck him and Korra into the cyclone. He tries to take Korra higher, but he can't because of the combined efforts of the airbenders. And Korra, seeing the advantage, pulls him down as he tries to leave on his own into the cyclone and crashes him into the ground. While Zaheer is on the ground, they earthbend him into a, like, kind of like a, you know, so he can't move his arms or do any sort of airbending, and Zaheer has been captured. Korra begins to fade. She's in the Avatar state. Her dad goes and catches her. And Jenora says to Sue, because of being in the cave and hearing what they said, which is great that she did the projection to see this, she says the poison is metallic and that she can heal her because she can pull the poison out, the metal out. And so Sue runs to Korra and removes the poison from Korra, and Korra awakes. 2 weeks later, and when she, by the way, when she awakes, Zaheer goes from super Billy Dee Williams, silky smooth voice, like, you know, we're gonna to like Cabbage Man. Cabbage Man, my cabbages! It was over. He was like, no! He was done. It was great.
Yeah. He was so calm and cool and collected until his plan just fell apart.
And then he goes into all, he's like, no, the revolution has already started. What are you doing? The revolution is done, buddy. You're done. You're finished. You know? Oh, man. But 2 weeks later, a plan does work out. And I'm really excited about this plan working out. Asami is helping Korra fix her hair in preparation for a ceremony at the air temple. Korra is down. She's pretty sad. And Asami does her best to cheer her up. But it really doesn't work. But Asami does say that she'll be there for anything she needs, to talk or anything. And she, you know, holds her hand and then starts to wheel her out because Korra's in a wheelchair. Outside the ceremony, President Raiko's garbage ass attempts to make amends. But Korra's like, nah, Korra's like, I love that nobody responds to him. I love that, like, he says all this stuff about, I'm ready to welcome you back to Republic City. And everybody's like, eh, we're good. Like,
I cannot stand this guy. I cannot.
Yeah.
Anyway, I made an audible groan when he came on screen.
Me too. I'm not a fan. This is one of the L's that I think the Red Lotus took that I wish was a W, was that they didn't get this guy. When Korra goes inside, the president says Korra doesn't appear to be doing well. He's concerned because the Earth Kingdom is in disarray. He's not concerned because she may not be doing well. He's concerned because of the political fallout, just like he's always been. And Zuko yep. notes that they also don't know how many Red Lotus members are still out there. It's a valid point. Raiko wonders who will protect them while Korra is recovering, which gives Tenzin a thought. So this ceremony that we've been talking about, this thing that I was saying, I'm very happy for a plan working out, is to anoint our girl. The one and only. She's not the only, but one, the oldest. Granddaughter of Katara and Avatar Aang, Jenora, as an airbending master. She's getting her arrows.
It's so cool.
Oh, it is.
It is hard not to get emotional because she looks exactly like
Aang. Oh my God, exactly. I got emotional watching it. When I see it, I'm like, oh my God. It's like to see Aang's granddaughter being anointed as a master, airbending master, by her dad, who's Aang and Katara's son. It's just like, oh my gosh, it's just so cool. It's really, really cool. It makes her journey well worth it. And in Tenzin's remarks, he says that the Air Nation will reclaim its nomadic roots and roam the earth, serving the people of all nations and bringing harmony to the world while the Avatar recovers. So he's basically trying to say, hey, Korra, just take take it easy. We got your back. You don't have to rush this thing. Because he loves Korra, and he doesn't want her to. Where Raiko's worried about the political fallout, he's worried about Korra. Like, he loves her. And when he pulls down Jenora's hood and reveals that she's received her tattoos and the shaved head, as you said, shades of Aang. It's just so beautiful. Book three ends, and it ends with the shot of Korra's face and a tear that streams down her cheek. And, you know, it's very clear that Korra has been through so much trauma that she's not fully recovered, and who knows how she will recover.
Yeah, it's so the scene is really beautiful, but the ending is really hard to watch, yeah, because it's clear that Korra is not teary-eyed for the same reason that we are. Yeah. Korra is teary-eyed because she feels lost. She feels hurt here.
Yeah.
She's still struggling, and it's hard to see the show close on that.
Yeah, it is. I agree, and it's
Korra is a lot of things, and we call her out when she is impulsive and difficult, and sometimes she can be a little ignorant and makes a lot of assumptions, but Korra is brave and strong, and to see her struggling so much is really hard. It's difficult to watch someone who you know to be brave and strong so detached from herself and so depressed.
Yeah, I agree. And it's interesting because, you know, the last waterbending avatar was Avatar Korra. And Korra also was very traumatized, like, by his experiences as the avatar. And it's just interesting to see how I often have been thinking about this, like, watching it this time around, knowing a little bit more of the history and the lore of the world, and thinking to myself, man, Korra and Korok are so connected in so many ways, the way that they've experienced, the way they experience different things in their lifetime. And I just find it interesting how the waterbending avatars seem to have these really deeply traumatic experiences that hurt them internally, like their spirit, their feeling, who they are, like loss of loved ones, loss of like them, their feeling of who they are themselves. And the world doesn't quite understand them. Like I feel like Korra sometimes feels like she's pretty alone because everybody pretty much has an agenda for what they'd like to see her do, even if it's a noble agenda. And it's pretty rough. I find that Aang approached that with a certain level of joy and responsibility. You hear a lot about, like, you know, Roku and how he approached it with a little bit too much forgiveness, but still, like, was, like, you know, able to, like, separate out his duty from, like, who he was as a person. You don't think so?
Roku started the 100-year war.
Yeah, but I don't think that it was... I agree. I'm not giving Roku a pass.
Okay, that's harsh. He didn't start it, right? Like, obviously, Sojin started. Yeah, Sojin started. But...
I'm not giving him
Roku
a pass.
Roku probably would have taken him out if that wasn't his best friend.
I agree. Yeah, I agree. I that's what I mean. I'm not giving him a pass. I'm just saying that he didn't... it didn't hit him in the soul the way that it is hitting Korra, or even like a Korra, like, or even Aang. They don't feel like they, like, took it on so much that it's, like, affected them from the standpoint of being sad or depressed. Like, Roku was, like, good until he was dead.
Yeah, I mean, I guess I do. So I think part of the issue here with Korra, something that we talked about a little bit before offline, which was that so much of this show is personally about destroying Korra.
Yeah.
And in Atla, Ozai's mission is not to destroy Aang or the Avatar. Ozai is a tyrant who wants to expand his power. Yes, he sends Zuko after the Avatar. He sends Zhao after the Avatar. Like, he wants to capture the Avatar, but it's not personal to the Avatar. It's not a personal attack on him. It's not You know, it's not Aang putting everyone in danger, which is another thing I think Korra really struggles with. Like, all these people almost died, essentially, because of her. It's I hear what you're saying. You're 100% right. I just don't, I feel like it's a little different because of what Korra's been through, not necessarily how she's been affected by it. Like, I think that the issue is that Korra is constantly being challenged on like a deeply spiritual and personal level. Zaheer wanted to annihilate the Avatar, so did Unalaq. Whereas we just haven't seen Aang face this. And I can't really speak to Kurik or the other Avatars because I haven't read the Kaioshi novel, so I don't know the background there, but I hear what you're saying. I feel for Korra because I think that the wound is so deep because it's so personal.
Yeah, I agree. And I think that's where I'm getting at. It's just profound. I think the creators are doing this, and I don't know why they're doing this, but I think it's profound that, like, the personal attacks, like, there seem to be personal attacks for the waterbending avatars, more than the Air Nomad avatars, more than the Fire Nation avatars, definitely more than Kaioshi. I mean, they're not personal attacks so much. They seem to navigate more political fallouts in the world or whatever it is, but these two, there's a connection between the two of them they haven't even addressed, right? So it's very interesting that she's broken this connection to all the avatars, because I think, like, I think she wants to talk to Aang. I think she would find better answers talking to Korra. That's like, you know, like how Aang in the comics, like, skips,
totally,
you know.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's interesting that when you brought up Kirk, my first thought was, it's really terrible that she can't talk to anybody about what she's experiencing, because I think Aang could help her navigate out of this suffering. It wouldn't be perfect. It may take multiple, meetings, but the way that Roku helped Aang essentially understand his purpose, she doesn't really have that. She's kind of just stumbling through purpose all the time. So it's tough. Korra, I mean, we're going to talk about season 4, and it's rough. Korra goes through a lot.
Yeah, I agree. And speaking of season 4, without giving too much away, Tonrak's wounds are being tended to by a metalbender named Kuvera. This is really one of the best introductions of a character that's going to be super consequential in this series. That, like, it's so subtly done multiple times throughout season 3, and she becomes a pretty consequential part of and substantial part of season 4, and I think it's really well done. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I think season 3 has some great foreshadowing for season 4.
Agreed.
There's like another moment where we kind of revisit the past in season 4 without spoiling for anyone who is trying to watch as we podcast. But we're going to revisit some of the stuff that happened before when Aang was still the Avatar. And some of it's been foreshadowed in season 3. There's just like a lot of good nods to what's coming. Mm-hmm. When I finished season 3, I was really not like, I was like, well, where did they go from here? Mm-hmm. You know, like this felt like the end of Korra's reign as the Avatar.
Yep.
And so I think season 4 is really fascinating because there's more story. There's a lot more story to tell. And listen, our group has gotten huge. That's one of the things that I wanted to talk about this week, is just how, look at how big Team Avatar is.
Yes, agreed.
You have the original 4 members, Korra, Mako, Bolin, and Asami, of this version of Team Avatar. I'm not saying they're the original
Team
Avatar.
Yeah, yeah, yeah,
I don't come in my mentions.
No. We're not.
I'm talking about the new Team Avatar. You have Tenzin, Jinora, Milo, Iki. You have Kaya, Bumi, Lin, and Sue. Zuko joins the fray this time. You also have Tonrok and the Metalbenders and all the Airbenders. Mm-hmm. Korra has assembled a little army.
Yeah.
And it's pretty dope. Like, Korra, I mean, Aang did this too. No, I'm not trying to say she's better at this than Aang, but what I will say about Korra is that even though she can be quite difficult on an interpersonal level, she gets people's devotion. They believe in her.
I agree.
She has a lot of followers and allies. I mean, she could not have beaten Zaheer without the Airbenders. It would have never happened.
There's no way.
And that's a testament of Jinora's love for her, and also Jinora knowing that you, when you bring people together, you can fight back. Tenzin and them had essentially given up. We don't know how to help her. Zaheer is too much of a formidable opponent. But Jinora was like, no, there's got to be a way.
Yeah, I agree. And I think some of what's interesting is that they do think they did that for each other, because, you know, Jinora was like, you know, pretty much like, Jinora was like a always like strong in her practice, but she was kind of like not experienced. And through all of these experiences that she's had in the spirit world, all the things she's done with Korra has enhanced her leadership capacity. I mean, she became a master. Like, we watch her come from like little girl who's just like interested in the stories to being like a master. Like, was the potential always there? Yes, but she's realizing the potential. I think some of that is that kind of like what Korra models for her, right? Of like, you know what, believe in yourself. Because Korra has a lot of self-belief, you know what I mean? Like, and believes mm-hmm. she'll be able to do it. And so that's really fascinating to me. And you know, I was just thinking as you were talking about Korra and everything we've been talking about her and how she's dealing with these things and the flashback thing. I think it made me go back to when we're first introduced to Korra and the two edges of this, the two sides of this coin, is that when we're first introduced to Korra, she says something, the first thing is, I'm the Avatar and you have to deal with it. And it's funny and we laugh about it, but everyone has either been an ally and dealt with her in that way, or has been hell-bent on destroying her. So that pronouncement is super powerful in this series. It's like, listen, I'm here and you're going to have to deal with me. And I think she's feeling the effects right now of like what that means in this world for her as a person. And it really hit me as we were talking about it. I was like, man, she's decided. I'm going to take up this space. I'm going to be the reason why. And like, I'm standing at this crossroads and you're going to have to deal with me, because nobody's getting through to the spirit world or the human world, you know, but going through me. And that has created some very positive things, like you're talking about, the allies. She's created almost more than a team. It's like an army. Like, there's so many people that you could say are part of this group of Team Avatar, besides just the core four. And then she's also consequently had the effect of very powerful entities in this world being her enemies, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So.
Yeah. And I think like with Amon, she probably, if she hadn't sort of taken that up as a challenge, maybe Amon wouldn't have bothered her.
Yep.
You know, like her being that brave person that she models for Jinora, that person who always believes there's something that she can do, right? Because Tenzin and them were sort of like telling, not encouraging her to go against the Equalist. Mm-hmm. They were going to send her back to the Water Tribe, and she was like, no, Republic City needs me. This is my job. That's what I'm here to do.
Right.
So I think that's a really good point about the I'm the Avatar and you have to deal with that. It's essentially Korra's model.
Mm-hmm.
Like, she's
mm-hmm.
you just have to deal with, you have, she's going, she's not going away. She's going to make you deal with whatever it is that the like conflict that she's trying to confront.
100%. What about, why was Zuko so surprised that Iroh would be in the spirit world?
I do want to talk very briefly, because, you know, I don't want to spend too much time on it, but I do want to just talk about some of the inconsistencies in both the behavior of like old Team Avatar, one of which is Zuko, and also just like Katara not even being around.
Yeah.
You know, flashback to book 2 when Katara sat a whole civil war out.
Yeah.
But I also want to talk a little bit about the inconsistencies of Korra in this. And so to go back to what you said about Zuko and Iroh, I found that shocking that Zuko had no idea Iroh was in the spirit world.
Yeah, me too.
He seems genuinely surprised when Korra says, "I was talking to Iroh."
And never revisited.
What did you make of that?
I did. I felt like, first of all, Milo being on the radio would not have stopped Zuko from revisiting that point, right? And if you weren't going to have him revisit that point, right, why bring up that that's why you went and talked to Zuko? Why not just make that something that we know as an audience is why you went and talked to Zuko and not make it weird, like your uncle was right, this and that and that. I feel like that was a little fan servicey. You know what I mean? It was kind of like, you know, hey, and you want to tell Zuko that, you know, you spoke to Iroh because you don't want to leave that out. I just don't think that Zuko would be so surprised about Iroh being so connected to the spirits. After all those years of traveling, those stories about who he was, and especially knowing, like, the fact that Iroh was so connected throughout his life to the spirit world and all the stories with him and how he dealt with, like, you know, the spiritual realm from, you know, Chui and La to the dragons, to all this stuff. Like, it's just so much. It'd be very easy for Zuko to, like, be like, oh yeah, okay, my uncle was in the spirit world. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I just, it was a weird moment. I didn't love it. I mean, I also just don't like Iroh's character being used like this.
Yeah, I'm with you on that one.
It's just not, it doesn't feel right. I'm not crazy about it. I felt like Zuko seemed kind of inconsistent in this season. And then I also just feel like it just goes back to the original characters. So, like, there's some things that Zuko does that feel right about his character that he would do that. The same is true for Katara, but it just feels like so much of the original characters got lost. I don't want to say changed, because, like, I feel like Aang's parenting, the issues that have come up about Aang's favoritism towards Tenzin, that tracks with who Aang could be. Aang could be very single-minded mm-hmm. when he had something in mind, right? Like, I think that he could, that totally tracks. I think he loved his children all equally, mm-hmm. but that it tracks that he would value the airbender above the others. I think it tracks that Zuko would be a devoted father. Family was something he never really got to experience, but I think it was something that was important to him.
Mm-hmm.
And he had a great model for a father, which was Iroh. But then there's just these little moments where I'm like, I don't recognize this character. And when Zuko was surprised that Iroh was in the spirit world, I could see him not knowing Iroh was in the spirit world. But then it appears that Iroh just kind of, like, entered the spirit world. So then what did Zuko think happened to his uncle?
Yeah, it's...
It just leaves more questions than answers. I didn't love it. It felt a little bit off, and it seemed to almost erase some of their relationship. I feel like Iroh would have let Zuko know where he was going.
Yeah, I agree with that. 100%.
So, not a big fan. But I don't, you know, I don't want to spend too much more time on it, because I could talk about how the show has changed our view of the original show's characters.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, I agree. And it's not to be negative. It's just that I think that they want to reference them, but they don't want to center them. And I think, like, in doing that, you know, the reality of it is that, I they do a really good job of writing the adults in this story, as we've talked about, and the intergenerational mm-hmm. kind of collaboration of trying to overcome a situation. And that even goes deeper next season and episode that we'll see. But I just think that they could have stood to, like, say, oh, it's okay for us to embrace that these characters are still here and that they're still active participants, similar to the way that Iroh was still an active participant in the Hundred Year War, even though he was, you know, he was older. You know what I mean? Like, he mm-hmm. was he was mm-hmm. not like a young man at that point. So it was I think, like, that's something I would have loved to have seen, is them, like, involve Katara in some of the fighting, involve Zuko, and Zuko was involved in some of the fighting, and obviously other characters that show up, you know. So
yep, totally agree.
So let's talk about this week's theme.
So I couldn't help but think just about all the moments of sacrifice in these episodes. Mm-hmm. It was pretty incredible. I just loved all of this, like, coming together and fighting together. So throughout this whole entire final battle, there's, like, a number of characters who stepped up to sacrifice themselves for their loved ones and or what they believed in. So Korra kind of kicks us off by being willing to give herself up to Zaheer. Mm-hmm. Kai and Tenzin are both willing to sacrifice themselves for the other airbenders. Mm-hmm. Pili stays behind to fight Lin and Sue so Zaheer can escape. Lin is then willing to sacrifice herself and die to protect her sister. Like, we've come so far in this journey, and Korra and her allies are just, like, pulling together so that Korra is never really fighting alone. And sacrifice is not, like, a new theme to fantasy stories. It's an enduring theme. It endears us to the characters of the fantasy stories. We think about Harry's willingness to sacrifice himself to defeat Voldemort. We think of Frodo's willingness to give up everything, mm-hmm. the entire Shire, his life, whatever, to destroy the One Ring. We think of Jorah Mormont fighting to the end to save his queen in Game of Thrones.
God, that one hits.
I'm still a little...
Yeah, that one. That's, I get a little misty about Jorah. I just saw the whole scene in my, like, wow. Yeah, goodness.
We recall Katniss Everdeen. Mm. Who spoke up and volunteered herself to save her sister Prim. Through sacrifice, characters show their devotion to those that they love, and the true strength of their bonds to each other come through. But sacrifice is also leadership by example. At the end of this season, Korra is broken and battered because she chose the welfare of the airbenders over her own life. Tenzin seizes on her example by pledging the service of the Air Nation to the other nations, helping Korra while she recovers, but more importantly, carrying on the true mission of the Avatar, which is to ensure the balance amongst the nations and kingdoms. It just feels like such a strong theme at the end of this season, and quite frankly, a beautiful one.
So beautiful. Like, man, good stuff. Good stuff, cuz. Wow. That was a good one. I actually... yeah, like that is very strong in these episodes, and it's a great call out, and all those just show the theme throughout all those stories is just beautiful. Well, here we are, one season of Legend of Korra left. We just appreciate you all so much. We enjoy taking these journeys and interacting with you, so please, please hit us up on all of our social channels and, you know, reach out to us anytime. And we will see you again to kick off season 4 next week. Have a good one.
Bye, everyone.